Karen and Paula. I don't like your cat. I don't like your house. And I don't like having to stay in my bed. There was so much it barely fitted in the space provided. Anything else? I asked. Yes, I don't like you, she said again. I think we've already covered that, I said, pointing to the first line. I then turned the page and read out the next question. What has gone well for you since your last review? I'll write N.A., which stands for not applicable, I said, as this is your first review. She eyed me suspiciously. Likewise, the next question was, what has gone badly since your last review? I read it out and told her I was writing N.A. again. Who are your friends? Was the next question. Anna said, don't know, which was very sad. Most children of Anna's age can name a few good friends. Who do you play with at school? I asked.
Anyone.
She shrugged despondently, but I could see the pain in her eyes. I didn't push it further, as I knew from Mrs. Taylor that Anna was struggling to make friends because she was very bossy and controlling. I wrote, Anna doesn't know who her friends are. The next question asked if the child would like to see more of their friends, and Anna shrugged, so I wrote, Anna wasn't sure. The following question was, if you have a problem, who do you talk to? She looked puzzled, so I rephrased it. If you have something worrying you, who would you tell?
Mrs. Taylor, she said.
I wrote Mrs. Taylor, Anna's teacher. Interesting, as most children would have said, Mummy. You know you can always talk to me and tell me your worries, I said. Anna ignored me, so I moved to the final question. Is there anything you want to ask? She shrugged, then said,
will I go home?
A question asked by most children in care, and I wrote it down. But Anna was looking at me for a reply. I don't know, love, I said. But for now, I will look after you. You won't have to move again until everything is sorted out.
Will I have to go on a plane again?
Not unless we all go on holiday.
When can I see my mummy?
Your adoptive mother, I clarified. Anna nodded. I'm not sure yet. Would you like to?
Yes, she said quietly.
My heart clenched. I'll write that down too, then. Anna would like to know when she can see her mummy, I said as I wrote. But would her mother want to see her? I had no idea, but I sincerely hoped so. Chapter 21 Review. On Wednesday, I met Jill in the reception of the council offices 10 minutes before Anna's review was due to start. We signed in the visitor's book and then made our way up to the first floor. Hopefully we'll meet Anna's parents, Jill said, voicing my thoughts. Yes, indeed, although I felt a familiar surge of nervousness at meeting the child's parents for the first time. Laurie was already in the meeting room, seated at the large oak table next to a man she introduced as the Independent Reviewing Officer, IRO. LAC reviews are chaired and minuted by an IRO, who is a qualified social worker with extra training and unconnected with the social services. Jill and I gave him our names and roles, supervising social worker and foster carer, as we sat and he noted these. I handed him the review forms Anna and I had completed, and he thanked me. The door opened and Miss Rich came in carrying a folder. The child's teacher or TA are usually invited to the review. Laurie introduced her to the IRO, and she sat on the other side of the table to Jill and me.
Are we expecting anyone else? The IRO asked Laurie.
She would have drawn up the list of those to invite and sent the invitations.
No, she said. The parents aren't coming.
I was disappointed, and also knew this didn't bode well for any hope of Anna seeing them or returning home. Sometimes there are many present at a review, or, as with Anna's, just a few. Even so, the formality is maintained. The IRO opened the meeting, thanked us for coming, and then asked us to introduce ourselves. We went round the table, stating our names and roles. Introductions over, he began by saying this was the first review for Anna Hudson, aged 5, although it was her 3rd foster care placement since coming into care. Background information like this would have been sent to him prior to the review. Then, as often happened in reviews, the IRO asked me as the foster carer to speak first, simply because the carer usually has the latest information on how the child is doing.
I glanced at the page of notes I'd brought with me and felt my pulse quicken. Although there were only five of us, all eyes were on me, and I took a deep breath. I always start by saying something positive about the child, even if they have very challenging behaviour. "Anna is eating well," I said, "has good self-care skills, and is going to school each day. She is also sleeping well now and in her own bed." "Well done," Laurie said, appreciating the significance of this.
"Where was she sleeping before?"
the IRO asked as he took notes.
With her parents, in their bed," Laurie said.
The IRO nodded and looked at me to continue. "Anna has some very challenging behaviour," I said, having exhausted the positives, "and I'm working on that. She is used to doing as she wants and being in control. It's taking time for her to learn that this isn't always in her best interest. She resists adult authority and struggles to show affection either verbally or physically. For example, she hasn't once said she misses her parents. She's also very confused about her past."
"In what respect?" the IRO asked, looking up from writing. "She was under three when she was adopted."
"Yes, but the past is still very vivid for her, and from what I have seen, it has created a lot of confusion and insecurity in her. She's not sure who her parents really are, and quite recently asked if she would have to go on a plane again, meaning to return to the orphanage."
"Coming into care couldn't have helped her confusion and insecurity," the IRO observed dryly as he made a note.
"She's been diagnosed with an attachment disorder," Laurie put in. "We've made a referral to CAMHS, Children's and Adolescent Mental Health Service, and the educational psychologist, but there is a waiting list for both."
The IRO nodded and looked at me.
"And presumably you reassure Anna and answer her questions as best you can?"
"Yes, although she doesn't really have many questions. She keeps it all bottled up."
"Why aren't her parents here?" the IRO now asked Laurie.
"Anna's mother didn't feel she could cope with it, and she wasn't sure what good it would do. I've only just traced the father, and he said he didn't think he could contribute much to the meeting. Both parents are struggling with what has happened."
The IRO made a note and looked to me to continue.
"I am helping Anna with her schoolwork and am working closely with Miss Rich, her TA.
Miss Rich nodded.
"Sometimes Anna is very resistant to learning and finds it difficult. She's on a reduced timetable at school." I didn't say any more about Anna's education, as Miss Rich would give her report later. "I try to involve Anna in my family's life, but often she prefers to play independently, in the same room. She finds it difficult to make friends."
"You have children of your own?"
the IRO asked.
"Yes, two."
"How does she get on with them?"
"She doesn't really," I had to say. "I've tried, and it's early days yet, but she struggles to know how to make friends. It's the same at school, and other children are wary of her angry outbursts."
"Is she angry often?" the IRO asked.
"Yes."
"How does she show it?"
"She screams and tries to hit and kick people and throw objects."
"What does she get angry about?" the IRO asked.
"Anything she doesn't want to do. I have to hold her sometimes when she is very angry to stop her from hurting herself or others. And you should know she can make things up. I've had a few incidents, which I've noted in my log, where Anna has said something that was blatantly untrue. Some of it she has repeated at school to her teacher and TA."
"For example?"
the IRO asked. "She said my son was bullying her."
"I take it he's not."
"No, of course not," I said, a little irritated. "She doesn't want anything to do with my children, and they are never alone. Anna was told off at school for bullying and retaliated by accusing my son of doing the same. My supervising social worker, Jill, is aware."
As the IRO made a note, Laurie added, "There was a similar incident at the previous carers." I looked at Jill. This was news to us.
"What happened?"
the IRO asked.
"Anna threw their cat down the stairs, and when I spoke to her about it, she said she'd done it because she was angry with the carer for hitting her. The carer is adamant she didn't hit Anna."
I held Jill's gaze. I should have been told at the start that Anna had made false allegations, instead of letting me find out the hard way.
"They were new carers and might not continue to foster now, which is a pity," Laurie added.
"Great pity," Jill said pointedly under her breath.
"Thank you, Kathy," the IRO said. "Is there anything else you would like to add?"
I glanced at my notes. Not really. Hopefully the referral to CAMS will help.
And Anna can stay with you until a decision is made on her future? He asked.
It was a standard question. Yes, she must. She can't have another move.
He nodded and now looked at Laurie.
Would you like to give your report next?
Laurie sat upright in her seat as I sat back in mine and tried to relax. I was still smarting at the IRO's suggestion that Adrian might have bullied Anna. The worry with unfounded allegations, apart from them being hurtful and causing trouble, is that they can leave a stain, even though they're completely untrue. Anna's previous carers wouldn't be the first to stop fostering because of being wrongly accused.
Anna is in care under a Section 20 at her mother's request, Laurie was saying. She was adopted from... And she gave the name of the country. The parents, Elaine and Ian, couldn't have children of their own. They followed the correct procedures for international adoption and passed the assessment. It seems likely that Anna was badly neglected as an infant in the orphanage and during the brief spell she spent with her birth mother. As a result, she failed to form positive attachments. She was diagnosed with reactive attachment disorder prior to coming into care, and I've asked for a copy of that report. The parents paid to see a psychologist privately, but I understand from Anna's mother that no treatment followed the diagnosis.
Laurie paused to allow the IRO time to write.
There is no contact at present, Laurie continued, and the care plan is that Anna should return home, but that is looking increasingly unlikely. The parents are separated now, and neither feels they can offer Anna a permanent home, so I'm looking into kinship carers, but that isn't hopeful. Both Elaine's parents are dead, Ian's parents are living but are in their 70s, and they had reservations about them adopting from abroad from the beginning. Ian has a brother, but they already have 3 children. Elaine's sister has been supportive, but she is single and has a career. She has said she will think about offering Anna a permanent home, but she hadn't planned to have children and would be reluctant to take a career break, which is what would be required for Anna's high level of needs. If she does put herself forward, then we will assess her. Relatives wanting to look after a child in care still have to be assessed and police checked, just as foster carers do, and they are not always accepted. Anna is in good physical health, Laurie continued, and she's up to date with her vaccinations and dental and optician checkups.
Any accidents or illnesses since coming into care? The IRO asked.
It was another standard question.
No, Laurie confirmed. And no exclusions from school, although she is on a reduced timetable. I know Miss Rich will cover that later.
Any complaints about Anna's care from the parents? He now asked.
This question was usually put to the child's parents if they were present. Anna's mother was concerned that Anna has had to move twice since coming into care, but appreciated why that was necessary. He made a note.
What are the parents' long-term wishes for the child?
They don't know. The mother is very distressed. Putting Anna into care was a last resort. She was close to breaking point, and I have advised her to see a doctor.
The IRO nodded.
And she doesn't want contact now?
No.
Will you be applying for a full care order?
He now asked Laurie.
Not at present, but the department will have to consider it in the future.
A full care order would transfer parental rights and responsibility to the local authority. With Laurie having finished her report, it was the turn of Miss Rich, and she looked slightly nervous and flushed as she started to speak. She had my sympathy. Speaking at a meeting is a bit of an ordeal if you aren't used to it. She began with some background information.
Anna was in the school's nursery from the age of 3 and a half, and then joined the reception class when she was 4. I have been her TA since last September. I give her support in the classroom in the morning, and take her with 2 others in a small group in the afternoon. She attends school from 10 o'clock to 2 o'clock each day.
When were her hours reduced? The IRO asked.
At the beginning of December.
So 3 months ago. Whose decision was that?
It was a joint decision between the school and the parents. They were still together then. Anna's behaviour at home had deteriorated badly, and she wasn't engaging at school, so it was thought reduced hours might help her cope. We were thinking she would return to a full timetable by the end of this term, but with all the recent disruption, we don't think she's ready yet.
How is her behaviour at school now? The IRO asked.
Very difficult at times. She is behind with her learning and struggles to concentrate. She becomes easily frustrated and then disruptive.
She's working at about a year behind her actual age. We've asked that the educational psychologist assess her. I've brought some recent test results with me. Would you like to hear them?
Yes, please, the IRO said.
Miss Ridge read out the test results, which showed Anna was working at reception level, about aged 4. Then she went through Anna's personal education plan, of which I had a copy on file at home. The IRO thanked her and said he'd make a note that Anna was working towards rejoining school full-time. He asked Jill if she would like to add anything, and she said, "My role is to supervise, support and monitor Kathy in all aspects of her fostering. We are in regular contact by phone, and I also visit her every month when we discuss the child's progress. Kathy is an experienced and dedicated foster carer, and I know she will ask for help and advice if necessary. Clearly, Anna is presenting some very challenging behaviour, but I am satisfied that Kathy is doing all she can to meet Anna's needs. I have no concerns and am happy with the level of care Anna is receiving."
"Thank you," the IRO said and smiled at me. "I have the review forms here that Kathy and Anna have completed," he continued, and opened Anna's.
"Thank you for helping Anna to complete it," he said to me. He knew this from the line at the end of the form where the person giving help writes their name and relationship to the child.
"It's important the review hears the child's views, so I will read out the questions and Anna's replies. The first question asks, 'Do you know why you were in care?' And Anna replied, 'Because I have been bad at home.'"
I heard Laurie draw a sharp breath while Jill said, "Oh dear," and Miss Rich's face fell. Pitiful though Anna's words were, they didn't hold the same impact for me now as when I'd first heard them. "I reassured her that wasn't so," I told the review. The IRO nodded and looked at Laurie.
"Perhaps you could follow that up next time you see Anna and reinforce that she isn't to blame for coming into care."
"Yes, of course," Laurie said.
"The next question," the IRO continued, "asks if the child knows who their social worker is, and Anna said she didn't, so Kathy reminded her. The next asks if the child wants to see more of their social worker, and her reply was no."
"Show me a child who does," Laurie said stoically.
"What do you think about living with your foster carer?" the IRO continued, reading from Anna's review form. Anna said nothing. The next question asked what the child doesn't like about living with their carer, and Anna said, "Kathy, Adrian and Paula, they're your children?" he asked, glancing up at me.
"Yes."
"Their cat, their house and having to stay in her own bed," he continued.
"Don't take it to heart," Jill said to me.
The next two questions concern the child's last review, so Kathy has written not applicable. The following is about her friends, and Anna said she doesn't know who her friends are, nor if she wants to see more of them. He looked at Miss Rich. "Doesn't she have friends at school? Most children her age do."
"Anna finds it difficult to make friends," Miss Rich replied. "The children are wary of her controlling manner and outbursts of rage. We are teaching her to share and how to relate to her peers. She is joining in more with group activities within the class and team games in PE.
"Thank you," the IRO said, making a note. The next question asks who the child would tell if something was worrying her, and Anna replied, "Mrs. Taylor."
"That's her class teacher," Miss Rich qualified.
"Well, that's positive. Anna knows she has someone she can talk to," the IRO said.
"Mrs. Taylor is fantastic with Anna," Miss Rich said passionately. "She has 2 nephews who are adopted, so knows some of the challenges and issues parents can face. She always makes time for Anna and was working closely with her parents. She was devastated when Anna had to go into care. Kathy has met her." I nodded. The IRO made a note and looked at Anna's review form again. I felt my pulse quicken. He had arrived at the last question, and I thought of Anna's response.
"The final question asks if the child wants to ask anything," the IRO read. "Anna said she would like to know when she can see her mummy."
There was silence. You could have heard a pin drop. Everyone in the room had heard what Laurie had said and knew it wasn't possible, and it was heartbreaking. I looked at the somber expressions of those gathered around the table, all of us wanting Anna to be happy. "It's so very sad," Miss Rich said, close to tears. "I knew her parents well, especially her mother, Elaine. We worked together to try to help Anna. We did everything we could. So did Mrs. Taylor. We never thought it would come to this."
I saw her bottom lip tremble.
"It's not your fault," Laurie said.
I'll speak to the mother again to see if I can persuade her to change her mind and see her daughter. Even if a child isn't returning home, it's in their best interest to have some contact with the parents.
Thank you, the IRO said.
He set the date for the next review and closed the meeting.
I left the room with Miss Rich, as Jill was staying behind to talk to Laurie.
Is there really no hope of Anna going home? She asked once outside, still visibly upset.
I honestly don't know, I said.
If Anna can't go home, will she be able to stay with you? She asked, as Mrs. Taylor had done.
It will depend on the social services.
She shook her head sadly.
She's not a bad kid.
No, I agreed. Chapter 22. Frightened of her daughter.
Anna wasn't a bad kid, to use Miss Rich's term, but she was putting my family and me under huge strain. I usually saw my parents every couple of weeks, but with everything going on around Anna, time had slipped by. Also, I wasn't sure if I should subject my parents to the stress of spending a day with Anna, unkind though that may sound. But when Mum invited us again to their house for Sunday dinner, we decided they'd come to us, as I thought Anna would feel more secure being on familiar territory. And also, when she did kick off, the damage would be done at my home and not at my parents'. They knew Anna had challenging behaviour because of what she'd been through as a child, and were very understanding and sympathetic, but the day turned out to be a disaster. Perhaps Anna thought she could get away with negative behaviour as we had guests, possibly because she had done at home, or maybe she was jealous of Adrian and Paula. I don't know, but she made herself as objectionable as possible right from the start. My parents gave Anna as much attention as they did Adrian and Paula, but it wasn't enough for Anna. She wouldn't settle to anything, and didn't want anyone else to either. She over-talked loudly if anyone tried to speak, to the point of shouting so no one could get a word in. She kept putting herself physically between my parents and Adrian and Paula to stop any interaction. She tormented Tosha by screaming at the poor cat until she fled outside, which upset Adrian and Paula and worried my parents. She pushed Paula off a chair simply because my mother was admiring the badge she was wearing and kept bumping into Adrian whenever he was close by. Mum told her off about it, but she put her hands over her ears and yelled rudely that she couldn't hear her, as she did sometimes with me. Usually I kept a close eye on Anna and didn't let her out of my sight for long. Aware of this, she made a point of repeatedly disappearing upstairs, so that I had to stop what I was doing to go up and bring her down, which of course took a while, as Anna never did anything the first time of asking. At the dinner table, she tipped juice all over Adrian's new jersey and trousers that he was wearing for the first time, especially for Nana and Grandpa's visit. I saw the look of satisfaction on her face as I mopped it up, and then he left to change. The whole day was pitted with similar disruptive incidents, and my parents understandably decided to leave early. Dad said he was concerned that Anna's behaviour was upsetting my mother.
"How long do you think she'll be staying with you?"
he asked as they said goodbye, also worried at the effect it was having on us.
"I'm not sure yet," I said, "but don't worry, I can handle it."
He looked doubtful.
"Let us know if there's anything we can do to help," Mum said. "I'm sure Anna will settle down soon."
Mum always looks on the positive side. A glass half full, not empty type of person. We said goodbye and I went upstairs to find Anna again. She was in Paula's room trying to break the head off her best doll. I told her off and said she would have an early night, which of course led to a full-scale tantrum. As Paula was still downstairs, Anna didn't see why she shouldn't be too.
"But she's been good,"
I said, loathing myself for having to say this, but Anna needed to learn.
"Hate you," she said. "Hate your parents, they're horrible."
She stuck out her tongue to emphasize this. That evening, as I wrote up my log notes, grateful at last for some peace, I thought of Mum's assertion that Anna would settle soon, just as the other children I'd fostered had, but I had doubts. Anna had been a very troubled child with a number of problems before coming into care. Now she'd been rejected by her parents. I feared it could be years before she settled down, if ever. The effect of trauma in infanthood, if not dealt with, can follow a child into their teenage years and beyond.
Some adults never recover from the neglect or abuse they suffered as a child and turn to drink and drugs to try to block out and numb their pain. On Wednesday, Jill telephoned for an update, as she did every week if we hadn't met. She knew that if I needed help or advice in the interim, or if there was an emergency, I would contact the agency straight away. When I'd finished updating her on Anna's progress, or rather lack of it, Jill said, "You're doing everything you can, but there's been a development." "Oh, yes." A development could mean anything, good or bad. "You remember at the review, Laurie was going to speak to Anna's mother, Elaine, to see if it was possible to establish some contact?" "Yes." It was 2 weeks since the review, and the last time Jill and I had spoken, it hadn't been mentioned, so I'd rather assumed it wasn't going to happen. "Laurie has spoken to Elaine, and she has agreed to see Anna for an hour a week." "Oh, I see," I said, taken aback. "Well, I suppose that's good." "Laurie wants the contact to be at your house. She thinks it will be less disruptive for Anna, and there is no reason why contact should take place at a family centre, as there are no safeguarding concerns." If a child is brought into care as a result of abuse or neglect, then contact is usually supervised at a family centre for a set number of hours each week. The expectation was that I would accept contact at my house. "Okay," I said. "It will just be Elaine, not Anna's father, and Elaine has only agreed to see Anna as long as you are present." "Agreed," I said. That word again, implying reluctance on Elaine's part. Most parents of children in care would jump at the chance to see their child. "Elaine is worried that Anna will be very angry with her," Jill said, "and of course she's feeling guilty for putting her into care." "I can appreciate that." "Laurie suggested contact took place straight after school, as Anna is on a reduced timetable, but I said that probably wouldn't work for you." "No, it wouldn't. Although Anna finishes early, her school is half an hour's drive away, so after I've collected her, I go straight to collect Adrian and Paula." "That's what I thought, so I suggested Saturday." "Yes, that would be better. What time?" "Shall we say 11? "All right. I'll telephone Laurie now and then get back to you to confirm. Laurie's asked if you can prepare Anna for her mother's visit, as she won't be able to see her before Saturday." Foster carers often have to explain and discuss contact arrangements with the child they are looking after. "Yes, I'll do my best," I said. "Thank you." We said goodbye. I had concerns about Elaine suddenly agreeing to see Anna. While it was generally considered positive for a child to be in touch with their parents, I'd have to make sure this didn't give Anna false hope. It wasn't about preparing Anna to go home, but just for her to see her estranged mother. And if Anna was going to remain in care, how much good would it do to re-establish their bond now, I wondered. Anna hadn't seen or heard from her mother since coming into care, and she hadn't asked to see her, as most children would. But then again, that could have been part of Anna's attachment disorder. I didn't necessarily mean she didn't miss or love her mother. She just didn't show it as other children might. That evening after dinner, I sat down with Anna, just the two of us, and explained what was going to happen on Saturday.
"She's coming on a plane?" she asked.
"No, love, in her car."
"But it's over the water. I've seen a picture of the sea from the plane window."
"Not your birth mother. She isn't coming." It had never occurred to me she might think that. "It's your adoptive mother who's coming to see you, the person you call Mummy. You've been living with her and your father for over 2 years." Finally, she understood.
"Good. I don't want to go to that other home. I was poor there and no one loved me."
"You won't have to go back there," I reassured her. "Your mummy and daddy adopted you, so you were their daughter. They are your mummy and daddy, even though you are not living with them right now. Adrian and Paula's daddy doesn't live with us, but he is still their father." She looked as though she understood.
"Will you be my mummy too if I stay here?"
How confusing this must be for her. "I'm looking after you like a mummy," I said with a smile, which was the best I could offer. But of course, suddenly being presented with the prospect of seeing her mother was very unsettling for Anna, and doubtless reignited many old insecurities. That night and the following, she had nightmares, crying out in her sleep. I was out of bed in a heartbeat and round the landing to her room to settle her.
I told Miss Rich that Anna would be seeing her mother on Saturday, and she was pleased and said she'd tell Mrs. Taylor. She said she would help reassure Anna and answer any questions she might have. But Anna wasn't a child who confided her worries easily, even to Miss Rich or Mrs. Taylor. It came out in her behaviour, which deteriorated badly at school and at home. On Friday, Anna thumped a child in her class for asking who I was and pushed over another child for looking at her. That night she didn't get to sleep until after 3 a.m. I let her sleep in on Saturday and asked Adrian and Paula to play quietly. Then at 9:30 a.m. I woke her. "Time to get up and get ready," I said.
"I'm not seeing my mother,"
she yelled angrily as soon as she was fully awake.
"You tell her not to come here. Do as I say."
Anna still believed she was in charge. "I can understand why you're angry and upset," I said evenly, "but your mother is coming here at 11 o'clock, as arranged."
"Why?"
she demanded. "Because she wants to see you, and that's what your social worker and your mother have decided."
"You don't have to do what they say,"
she stormed, her eyes blazing. "Yes, I do. We both do."
"Why?"
"Because they are responsible for you."
"I won't let her in,"
she yelled, bawling her fists. I felt my anxiety level rise. "I will. Come on, up you get. Time to get dressed."
"I'll push her out of the door and shut it in her face," she said, her cheeks flushed with rage.
"That would be very unkind, and you won't be doing that because I will be letting your mother in and making her feel welcome." I hoped, after all this, that Elaine turned up. Some parents arrange contact and then don't show, which is very disappointing and distressing for the child and adds to their feelings of rejection.
"Hate you,"
she said, but did get out of bed. Anna never did anything the first or second time she was asked, so as a result of her lack of cooperation, it was nearly 11 o'clock before she was finally ready, having washed, dressed and finished her breakfast. During this time, Adrian and Paula had been left to get on with it yet again, while I concentrated on Anna, and although I was grateful for their cooperation and praised them, I felt guilty. It was their weekend too. I put a lot of thought into how to handle Anna's first contact with her mother. Sometimes when I facilitated contact at home, I gave the child and their parents privacy, a room to themselves, and just popped in occasionally to see if everything was all right and if they needed anything, while keeping Adrian and Paula amused in another room. But Elaine had specifically asked that I be present when she saw Anna, so I took a selection of games, puzzles and toys into the living room for them to play with, and told Adrian and Paula to carry on as normal. This would hopefully also feel less intimidating and more relaxing for Elaine, but Anna wasn't having any of it.
"You can put those away,"
she stormed, and grabbed some of the boxes of games to take out.
"I'm not seeing her."
I was about to return the games to the living room when the front doorbell rang, signalling Elaine's arrival. Startled, Anna threw the games onto the floor and fled upstairs to her bedroom, slamming the door behind her. "It's okay, don't worry, she'll be down later," I reassured Adrian and Paula, who were looking worried. I knew that Anna wouldn't stay up there for long if she thought her mother and me were downstairs. She'd want to know what was going on. However, I understood why she'd fled. An angry exit was her way of dealing with a difficult meeting. I was feeling nervous, and as I opened the front door, it was obvious Elaine was too. "Have I got the right house?" she asked in a small, quivering voice. "If you're Elaine, then yes," I said lightly. "Come in, I'm Kathy."
"Oh, thank you."
She was older than in the photographs, of average height and build, but with blue eyes, pale skin, and her hair cut in a neat bob like Anna's. They were so similar that Elaine could have been her birth mother. "Shall I take your coat?" I asked.
"Yes, please."
She began unbuttoning it, her nervous fingers struggling with the buttons. Under her coat she wore navy slacks and a beige jumper. "You found the house okay, then?" I asked, making conversation.
"I was early. I've been sitting in the car."
She passed me her coat and I hung it up. Then she nervously set down her handbag and picked it up again, unsure of where to put it. "Bring it with you if you like," I said. "We're in the living room. Anna has just gone up to her room. I'll fetch her if she doesn't come down shortly."
"Oh, so she isn't down here,"
she said, apparently relieved she wasn't having to meet her daughter straight away. This was so different from other reunions I'd witnessed, where the child or children I was fostering flew into their parents' arms and the parents cried with joy. "This is my son, Adrian, and my daughter, Paula," I said as we entered the living room.
"Hello," Elaine said in a small voice.
They smiled back shyly. "Would you like a coffee or tea?" I offered her, but she didn't want anything to drink. "Do sit down." Going to the sofa, she perched, stiff and upright, on the edge. I sat at the other end while Adrian and Paula continued playing on the floor. There was an awkward silence. "I'll fetch Anna down if she doesn't appear soon," I said again. Elaine nodded. Another silence. "I've met Miss Rich and Mrs. Taylor," I said. "They're very nice."
"Yes, they are," Elaine agreed,
her gaze on Adrian and Paula.
"How do your children get on with Anna?" she asked.
"Your daughter is only small." "Paula is not much younger than Anna," I said.
"Does Anna play with them?"
"We're working on it," I said, throwing her a small smile. She understood. There was another silence, and then Adrian asked,
"Mum, can I go upstairs to play?"
"Yes, of course, love. Do what you would normally do." "Sorry, I've disrupted your morning," Elaine said apologetically.
"You haven't," I replied. "We're used to having visitors."
"Anna isn't," Elaine said,
and looked at Paula as she followed Adrian out of the living room.
"Are you sure you wouldn't like a drink?" I offered again. "No, thank you. I'll see Anna and then I'll go. I won't stay for long."
"Laurie suggested an hour, but it's up to you." I looked at her so tense and uneasy, I thought she could leave at any moment. "Elaine, I know this must be very difficult for you, but Anna does need to see you."
"Yes, that's what Laurie said, but I'm not sure. She doesn't really like me."
"No child likes their parents the whole time. It's part of the territory of being a parent, but I'm sure she loves you."
"Thank you," she said in the same slight voice, but didn't offer any more.
At that moment, Anna's bedroom door opened with a loud thud, and footsteps stomped towards the top of the stairs. "That sounds like Anna," I said.
"You will stay with us, won't you?" Elaine asked anxiously.
"Yes, of course, don't worry. Just enjoy your time together." But even as I said it, I knew that was going to be very difficult for Elaine. Anna came heavily down the stairs, stomping as she did when she was annoyed. Elaine tensed even more, as if steeling herself to meet her daughter.
"Try to walk more quietly," I called to Anna as she entered the hall.
The stomping continued with marginally less force. "Good girl, that's better." Elaine looked at me curiously.
"She does what you tell her."
"Eventually. But we've had the stomping conversation before," I replied with a smile. Anna's heavy footsteps continued along the hall, into the living room, and then she stomped right up to her mother. I saw Elaine draw back.
"Why are you here?"
Anna demanded, hands on hips. Elaine didn't reply, but her brow creased as if almost imploring Anna not to be cruel to her.
"She's come to see you,"
I said, concerned by Elaine's reaction. She appeared to be frightened of her daughter.
"Why?"
Anna demanded, glaring at her mother. What I now wanted was for Elaine to say, "Because I love and miss you," and Anna would reply, "I love and miss you too, Mummy," which would start the healing process and begin to build the bridge across the huge divide between them. But that wasn't going to happen. Elaine just sat looking at her daughter, so I stepped in. "Anna," I said firmly, "take your hands off your hips and don't glare at your mother like that, please. I told you she was coming to see you."
"I want her to go," she said,
but did take her hands from her hips. Elaine made a move as though she was actually going to leave.
"Your mother is not going anywhere for now," I said, touching Elaine's arm. "She has come to see you. I think it would be a good idea if the three of us played one of those games together."
I'd found in the past that tension in first meetings was often eased if the parents and child were involved in a game, although those times had been a result of shyness and awkwardness, not intimidation, which is what I was witnessing.
"Would you like to choose a game, or shall I?"
I asked Anna, using the closed choice technique, and aware she'd want to.
"Me,"
she said,
and stomped off to the toy box. Elaine breathed an audible sigh of relief. Chapter 23 Save a Child. Elaine managed to stay for the full hour, but her relationship with Anna didn't improve. Despite my arranging board games and cards to play and illustrated books to look at and giving lots of encouragement, mother and daughter went through the motions of playing without any real involvement or meaningful interaction passing between them. It was difficult, to say the least. I was there to facilitate and support contact. I couldn't force them to get along. On the positive side, Anna did at least join in when she might not have done, but she was rude and demanding throughout, barking instructions at her mother and generally demeaning her. Elaine took this and even apologized, instead of telling Anna not to speak to her like that. I corrected Anna a number of times when I couldn't ignore her rudeness any longer, but it should have come from her mother. Adrian and Paula joined in the final game of Snakes and Ladders. It was the first time we'd all played together with Anna, so I suppose that was a positive too, although the atmosphere was tense and not at all like when Adrian and Paula usually play, with squeals of delight at winning a point or sighs of frustration at losing. Anna didn't win, although I'm sure her mother would have let her just to keep the peace. Anna was furious and threw the board and counters all over the floor while shouting that it was a silly game, just like a spoilt child. It was left to me to tell Anna about her behaviour. Elaine just sat looking at her, anxious and ineffectual. "It's not about winning, but playing the game that counts," I said to Anna. When the hour was up, I was as relieved as Elaine appeared to be. She immediately stood and said it was time for her to go, and Anna didn't protest either. I'd seen children cling desperately to their parents to try to stop them from leaving at the end of contact, with all of them in tears, which, while upsetting to watch, was far healthier than the cold and emotionless parting of Elaine and Anna. "Goodbye," Elaine said in the hall as she put on her coat. Anna stared at her blankly. "Safe journey," I said, opening the front door. "We'll see you at the same time next week." She nodded without conviction, and I wondered if she would come back. By the time I'd closed the door, Anna had disappeared into the living room. It had been the strangest, most emotionless and joyless contact I'd ever seen. Adrian and Paula, perhaps fearing another outburst from Anna, had gone upstairs. I went into the living room. Anna was sitting on the floor, uncharacteristically quiet and still. "Are you okay?" I asked, going over.
"Is she coming back next week?" she asked blankly.
"Your mother?" "Yes, she should do. Would you like her to?"
"Not bothered,"
she shrugged. And that was all she said about her mother and her visit, not only for the rest of the day and weekend, but for the whole of the following week, despite my bringing up the subject from time to time and asking her if she wanted to talk about it.
"No,"
she replied, or just ignored me. I wrote up my log notes, and Jill and Laurie telephoned for updates on how the contact had gone. They were disappointed when I told them, as was Miss Rich. On Wednesday morning, when I took Anna into school, Mrs. Taylor made a point of coming to see me to try to find out more, but I could only tell her what I told Jill and Laurie. She looked crestfallen. "Do you think it would help if I spoke to Anna and Elaine?" she asked. "Anna hasn't mentioned seeing her mother to me or Miss Rich." "I don't know. It's your decision. I'm sure it wouldn't do any harm."
"I'll give it some thought," she said.
I never found out if she did speak to them, but very soon it was Saturday again. I'd heard nothing to the contrary from Laurie, so I assumed that contact was going ahead. It was now the beginning of April, and the garden was awash with brightly coloured spring flowers, bringing with them the promise of hope, new life and opportunity. Or that's how I saw it, at least. I still had some doubts that Elaine would show, so I was relieved when at exactly 11 o'clock the doorbell rang. She seemed slightly more at ease, if only from now being familiar with my home and us. She took off her jacket and hung it on the hall stand, left her shoes in the hall and then headed for our living room. "Anna will be down soon," I said, and offered her a drink, which she refused.
"You have a nice big garden,"
she said, making conversation and glancing through the patio windows. "We're out there as much as possible in the summer. Do you have a garden?"
"A small one."
We sat on the sofa and continued making polite and somewhat stilted conversation, mainly about the weather, while we waited for Anna. Adrian and Paula were at the table in the kitchen, dough modelling. Anna hadn't wanted to join in. I could have gone up and fetched her down to see her mother, but it would be better if she came down of her own accord. She'd heard her mother arrive. As we waited, I told Elaine about Anna's week at school, but the conversation we should have been having was about her relationship with her daughter and whether there was any chance of them having a future together. I needed Elaine to broach the subject when she felt comfortable to do so, which clearly wasn't yet. Eventually, Anna's bedroom door crashed open and she stomped down the stairs. "Tread more lightly, please," I called. "You are not the BFG." Elaine almost smiled, but as soon as Anna appeared in the living room, she tensed, as if bracing herself to meet her daughter again. It was ludicrous and very unhealthy. If Elaine could have taken the initiative and said, "Hi, Anna, how are you?" standing up if necessary, it would have given her more presence. Instead, she waited, almost cowering, as Anna came right up to her, formidable and intimidating. Anna had quickly stopped approaching me like that, but she was doing it to her mother because she knew she could get away with it. "Say hello to your mother nicely," I said to Anna. "Hello," she said, and stomped over to the toy box. Adrian and Paula appeared and, bless them, suggested that we play snakes and ladders as we had done last Saturday.
"Don't want to," Anna scowled. "It's a silly game."
"It's a fun game," I said. "But you can choose something else to play if you like, and we can play snakes and ladders another time." She picked up a pack of cards.
"Snap," she said. "I want to play snap."
"Okay, but we'll need more than one pack if we're all going to play."
"No, just her," she said,
pointing at her mother. While it was positive that Anna wanted to play a game with her mother one-to-one, the way she'd referred to her and pointed was rude. I glanced at Elaine, wondering if she would correct her, but she stood and went over to play.
"She's your mother," I said to Anna, "not her."
I knew Anna had understood what I meant from her scowl. Elaine sat on the floor opposite her daughter while she divided up the pack of cards. The two of them began to play snap while Adrian, Paula and I played snakes and ladders. Any cries of glee or groans of frustration as we played were smothered by Anna barking instructions at her mother and yelling "Snap!" at the top of her voice every few seconds while grabbing the two stacks of cards. I was pretty sure she was cheating, but Elaine didn't say anything. She just went through the motions of playing the game. When Anna inevitably won, she gave herself a clap.
"I've won!" she shouted.
"Well done," I said. "I hope it was fairly." She threw me a look. Again she had got the message. Anna then wanted to play snakes and ladders. "Of course, love," I said. "Once we've finished this game, we'll all play together." She scowled. I really think she assumed we'd stop playing and start a fresh game straight away, simply because she wanted to. It didn't take us long to finish the game, and we then widened our circle to accommodate Anna and Elaine. Anna wanted the blue counter that Adrian was using, and tried to take it from him. "No," I said, stopping her. "Adrian is using the blue counter. There are plenty of others to choose from." I pushed the other counters towards her so she could pick one. She hesitated, a standoff, and Elaine tensed. But Anna clearly thought better of it and took another counter. "Good girl," I said. Then to Elaine, "It's okay to say no sometimes." She gave a slight nod. We played three games of snakes and ladders, of which Anna won one fairly. "Well done," I said, with genuine feeling.
"Yes, well done,"
Elaine repeated in a small, flat voice. Years of looking after children has taught me that it is important to praise a child effusively when it's due. Not only does it build their confidence, but it makes correcting them when necessary more acceptable. Like many aspects of child rearing, it is a balancing act. Praise and censure, talking and listening, encouraging a child to do something and warning them not to. Elaine's "well done" was as passionless as all her interactions with Anna, and I thought it was probably a safety mechanism to protect herself. If she didn't give anything of herself to her daughter, then her rejections were less painful. The hour slid by, and at exactly 12 noon, Elaine said it was time for her to go. Anna didn't want to come with us to the door, but said goodbye to her mother in the living room, again without any regret at her going. In the hall, I took Elaine's jacket from the stand and helped her into it. "Same time next week, then," I said. She nodded, said goodbye, and left. That evening I wrote up my log notes, and the following week updated Jill and Laurie when they telephoned. Soon it was Saturday again, and the third contact was the same as the previous two. I wondered how long it would be before one of them broke through the barrier and showed some real emotion. I realized that it was part of Anna's attachment disorder, that she wasn't able to show love for her mother, and that Elaine was probably feeling a lot more than she showed. But this couldn't go on indefinitely. They would both need to change if there was any chance of them having a future together, and I hoped therapeutic input would help, although no appointment had come through yet. At the end of Elaine's fourth visit, which had been no different to the previous three, she stopped as she was halfway out of the door and almost as an afterthought said, "Kathy, can I talk to you alone one time? I think you may understand." "Yes, of course," I said. "We could talk on the phone, or if you're not working, you could come here during the day when everyone is at school."
"I could come on Monday," she said in the same small voice.
"Good. 11 o'clock would suit me. Give me time to get back from school."
"Yes, I'll be here, and thank you for looking after Anna. You're doing a good job."
Her eyes filled, and she hurried down the path to her car. On Sunday, Adrian and Paula went out with their father again, which gave me the opportunity to spend some one-to-one time with Anna. It was Anna who suggested we play some board games together, which was a first. As we played, it struck me how much less rude and threatening her manner was towards me than her mother.
"Why do you speak to your mother so harshly?" I asked as we played.
"You're not very nice to her sometimes." Actually, it was all the time.
"Because I don't like her, and she doesn't like me."
"What makes you think she doesn't like you?"
"Because she was always telling me off."
"Any other reason?" She shook her head and rolled the dice. "How did she tell you off?" I asked. Given the tension that must have existed at home, I wondered if Elaine had hit Anna. My gut feeling was that she hadn't, but then I couldn't visualize her shouting either. She always appeared so meek and self-effacing. Anna finished counting her piece round the board before answering.
"She shouts and then she cries a lot, and I don't like that."
"Did she hit you?"
"No,"
Anna said, jutting out her chin aggressively.
"I hit her,"
which I knew to be true.
"You mustn't hit your mother or anyone. You have to talk to the person about what is bothering you, not hit them." "I hit you," she said defiantly,
"when you first arrived, but I stopped you." I found in the past that often young children open up and talk if they have the distraction of playing a game, more so than if you sit them down specifically to have a heart-to-heart.
"My other mummy used to hit me," Anna added.
"You remember that?" I asked, surprised.
"She hit me a lot. She said I was bad like my father."
How much baggage from her past this poor child carried with her. I doubted she and her parents had ever stood a chance of a normal, loving relationship. "Did you ever see him?" I asked.
"No. He was so bad they locked him up."
So I assumed he was in prison for whatever crime he had committed.
"My mum hated him, and she hated me too," Anna said, staring at the board.
"Have you ever talked to your parents or anyone about this?" She shook her head.
"Come on, your turn."
I threw the dice and counted my piece round the board. "Do you think you could talk to someone, like a doctor?"
"Don't know."
We continued to play for a few moments, and then I asked, "Did your daddy ever tell you off or hit you? The one you lived with?"
"When he came home from work and mummy was upset, he'd shout at me. He said it was my fault she was crying."
While I could see only too clearly why he would have felt that, for Anna it must have seemed that history was repeating itself,
another nail in the coffin for her relationship with her parents. I didn't know the reason why Elaine wanted to talk to me, other than she thought I would understand, so I assumed it was about why she had put Anna into care. I'd made a note of her request in my log and would update Jill and Laurie on what Elaine said the next time we spoke, unless it was something urgent, in which case I would phone them straight away. Monday was another fine, warm spring day, and Elaine arrived punctually at 11 a.m., dressed in a lightweight trouser suit and matching blouse. "You always look so smart," I said as I let her in.
"Thank you. It's a habit from when I used to work as a legal secretary. We had to look smart for the clients."
I smiled, waited while she hung up her jacket, and then led the way into the living room where I offered her a drink. For the first time since she'd started visiting, she accepted, and I made us both a coffee. Once settled, Elaine began making conversation by asking what work I used to do. "Clerical and administration," I said. "I still do a little now, part-time, mainly from home to fit in around the children." She sipped her coffee, admired the garden, and appeared far more relaxed than she usually did when Anna was there.
"I hope I'm not stopping you from doing anything," she said after a few moments, setting her cup in her saucer, "but there isn't anyone else I know who would understand."
"It's fine," I said. "I'm free until 1:30, when I have to leave to collect Anna from school." This wasn't strictly true, as I had a long list of jobs to do, but if Elaine needed to talk about Anna, then I would listen. She looked around the room as though gathering her thoughts, then took a small breath.
"It's difficult for me to talk about it all, even though you're in the same position."
I didn't understand what she meant about being in the same position. Yes, I had children, but my children weren't in foster care. I waited. With another little sigh, summoning her courage to begin, she asked,
"When you and your husband separated, did you try to get him back?"
I was completely thrown. It was the last question I'd expected. Surely this wasn't the reason she'd wanted to see me. "Well, yes," I said, "I did, but it wasn't really an option. It was his decision to leave. He'd met another woman." The words still choked me, although they weren't as raw now as when it had first happened.
"I'm sorry," Elaine said. "My husband didn't leave me for another woman, but because of Anna and me. Me, really. It was my fault. I've changed so much since we had her. I was unrecognizable from the person he used to know. I should have seen it coming. There were enough warning signs, but I was so wound up in my own misery and failings as a mother that I had no time for what Ian was going through. Ian was my first love. We met..."
And Elaine began telling me how it all began.
"Ian and I met by chance in a coffee bar close to where we both worked," she continued in a small voice as though viewing the scene from the distance of time. "We kept bumping into each other as we collected our coffee and sandwiches to eat at our desks. His firm had offices not far from mine. He started smiling and saying hello. Then one day, as we waited to be served, we found ourselves standing next to each other, and he struck up conversation. After that, we used to look out for each other and stand together in the queue and chat as we waited. I so look forward to lunchtimes. The girls at work used to tease me. After a month or so, Ian said, 'We can't keep meeting like this,' and he asked me on a date. That was the start of it. We began seeing each other regularly and quickly fell in love. I met his family and he met mine. I was rather a shy, unadventurous young secretary, but he gave me confidence and brought me out of myself. After 3 years, Ian asked me to marry him, and I had no hesitation in saying yes. We got engaged, saved up, and bought a home of our own. We had a beautiful, romantic white wedding that my mother planned." Elaine absently fiddled with the wedding and engagement rings on her finger. "Tragically, within the year, both my parents were dead. My mother died of cancer and my father of a heart attack. He never got over my mother's death."
"I'm so sorry," I said.
"Thank you. Ian was fantastic, so supportive. I don't know what I would have done without him."
She let out a heartfelt sigh.
We always knew we wanted a family. But the months, then years passed and nothing happened. Eventually we went to see our doctor, who sent us to the hospital for infertility tests. The results weren't a huge shock. After all those years of trying,